I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We have the latest on the shooting deaths of those 10 aid workers in Afghanistan. The 10, six Americans, a German, a Brit, and two Afghans, were members of the Christian charity the International Assistance Mission. The Taliban is claiming responsibility for their deaths. Speaking in Kabul today, the group's director, Dirk Franz, said their work will go on despite the attack.
As things stand right now, IAM is not thinking of withdrawing from Afghanistan. Our NGO has worked here for well over four decades. And we remember that there were times when security was much worse.
Franz also denied the Taliban claim that the workers were spies or were trying to convert Muslims by handing out Bibles. The 10 were gunned down last Thursday after finishing a two-week mission providing medical care. Washington Post foreign correspondent Joshua Partlow joins us from Kabul. And Joshua, what else did the director of IAM, the International Assistance Mission, say?
Well, he also said some of what we've known for a day or so. He identified the remaining members of the team who have been killed, which included translators, the videographer, an Afghan cook, the medical team itself. And he also said that the bodies will be flown back to the United States for autopsies, at least some of the Americans, although some of the family members are hoping eventually that they will be buried in Afghanistan.
Really? Well, this is because these people were devoted to their work, as their leader said, for decades. And as you write, they dealt with the Soviets during the Soviet occupation, with the Mujahideen fighters after they overthrew the Soviets, with warlords, and with the Taliban before.
Yeah, they've had a really long and complicated history here. I sat down with some of the group members yesterday, and they're telling stories about their history here, and they've had, during the Russian time, they were restricted to Kabul. They couldn't even leave the capital city during the Mujahideen government when Kabul was being bombarded by rockets from different factions. They were scurrying across town and negotiating with different fighters to get to work, and during the Taliban, the men were segregated from the women. So they've had a lot of difficult times here, and they are really a selfless group of people, it sounds like, from the work they try to do.
Right. Well, the Afghan driver for the team is a lone survivor. We understand he was taken in for questioning. He tells a horrific tale of what happened. The aid workers lined up and executed as they begged for mercy. He says he was spared because he pleaded with them, saying he was Muslim. First of all, is there any sense that he might have set up the group?
That's been speculation since this attack started, primarily because it's unusual that one person would have survived and 10 others were killed. Two other Afghans were also killed. So the argument that he makes that he was spared because he was a Muslim doesn't make complete sense. But no one has any evidence at this point or is actually accusing him of setting up the group. But he is the key to, I think, really understanding the story from here on out.
Well, because as you write, he also says that some spoke in languages he didn't understand, meaning that these could have been some foreigners in the group. Foreigners, Chechens, Pakistanis, sometimes fight with the Taliban. But is there a sense, as was speculated over the weekend, that maybe this wasn't a Taliban attack, that maybe these were low-level criminals?
That definitely could be a possibility. There was a robbery on the Land Rovers. They stole all their belongings, computers. So robbery was definitely involved. Whether it was the main motive or not is unclear.
Well, and you give us a fascinating detail, Joshua. Abdullah Abdullah, the runner-up in Afghanistan's presidential election last year, trained as an ophthalmologist with this group.
Yeah, they've had he's pretty well-known as a doctor. I mean, he worked as an ophthalmologist before going into politics with the Northern Alliance and with Ahmed Shah Massoud, the resistance and guerrilla commander. And yeah, he spoke yesterday about this organization and really had just glowing things to say. He thought they were not proselytizing. He thought that they were really just doing humanitarian work.
I guess that just also adds to the question, will this further drive Afghans into fear, this attack, or will it enrage them, given that this group has done so much work? What do you think the response is going to be?
There are regularly tragedies here, and for the Afghans, I don't know whether this will galvanize any additional response. I mean, definitely for the international community here, this is a major event, and that's shaken people and will affect how groups like this operate in the country. There's already been a lot of a contraction, and people take security into account to a great degree, and they've already pulled back from provinces around the country, different aid groups have. And so I think this will just further that entrenchment.
That's Washington Post foreign correspondent Joshua Partlow speaking to us from Kabul. Joshua, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Well, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton condemned the killings and also what she called the Taliban's transparent attempt to justify the unjustifiable by making false accusations. Well, Hillary Clinton also has responded to concern that women in particular will be victimized by the Taliban after the planned drawdown of U.S. troops next summer. Clinton said she's drawn a red line around women's rights. But as we've reported here, women are increasingly being threatened in Afghanistan. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has talked of reconciliation with the Taliban, even as last week's Time magazine showed women horribly mutilated by them. We want to get a unique view of this uptick in violence from two women who've seen it firsthand. A U.S. mom whose daughter was killed by the Taliban and now has pledged to help bring Afghan women to Wellesley College here in the Boston area through a new foundation. And also Parnian Nazari, who got herself to Wellesley and graduated this year. Let's start with Parnian. She was a 10-year-old student at a secret girls' school in Kabul in 1996, the year the Taliban first came to power, when gun-wielding Taliban fighters burst into her classroom and shut it down. She then educated herself, watching smuggled films like The Lion King and Titanic, making her way to the U.S. through a peace organization, talking her way into a boarding school here, and finally into Wellesley College. She graduated this year. We asked Parnian to tell her story, starting with that secret school she attended as a child.
It was a secret school, and it was only in a very small apartment above some stores. And there were about 20 students in my class.
Not a lot of books? Or
No. We brought our books. We hid them under our clothes. And for example, I was carrying them in a shopping bag and changing my route every day when I was going from home
to the school. Well, and then these gunmen come in. Were there really guns? Did you see guns?
Yes, there were guns and also whips in their hands. Usually,
whips.
Yes. Mm. Actually, that wasn't the only time I had seen the Taliban with the whips and guns. I had seen them a few times before, and I remember actually even being hit on my back for not wearing the burqa.
Hit on your back.
Yes.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's as we said, in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And there were emails flying around about this, about the way women were being treated in Afghanistan. This is before 9/11. After 9/11, many people hoped that in going after al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, the plight of women in the country would be addressed, and it was. But as we're hearing, it's now changing back. We want to ask you about that. But after those gunmen come in, you literally stayed inside your home for several years. So how did you learn?
My family is, they are all educated, and I have older sisters who all went to university, and my parents, they helped me at home to study. I was in sixth grade when the Taliban came in, and then I finished sixth grade in seventh and eighth grade at home during those years.
And then you're finally able to leave Afghanistan because of the Seeds of Peace summer camp up in Maine. We've reported how they bring children from war zones to Maine. While you're there, you apply to Phillips Exeter Academy. Did you even ask your parents if you could go to Phillips Exeter?
I actually did. When I was at Seeds of Peace camp for the first summer, it was for the first time that as a woman I felt free, and I felt the joy of just being able to walk around, run around. I was only 15. And I knew, I had just seen a part of the world for women that was so unfamiliar to me before. I didn't know a woman actually could do these things, yeah. Just simple things. And then I set my mind that I want to really live my life like that. And I want to come back here and study. And the next summer when I came in, the director of admissions from Phillips Exeter Academy was there. I just asked one of the counselors and said that, you know, I want to go to base the school in the U.S. And she introduced me to Michael Gary, the director of admissions. And I ran and called my family. It was my mom on the phone. I said, Mom, I'm meeting with director of admissions and I am planning to apply to school in the U.S. Can I do it? She thought about it. She said, sure, go for it now.
Yeah, and you did. You sat down. You wrote your essay right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I sat next to him. He was actually amazed that, you know, you can take some time and send it back to me. He said, no, once I go to Afghanistan, I cannot complete the applications. There might be no way that I get these mailed them on time for you. And I might not be able to take the tests that you require me to do. So I will never be able to apply for a school. I sat next to him and said, if it's okay, I will just use your table to fill out applications.
Now, then you do come to the U.S. One suitcase, $200, limited English. You're tutored, you study. And you then get into the Ivy League Wellesley College. What was that like?
It was such a joy for me when I got accepted and I just signed the slip, put it under my pillow and slept and said, I am definitely going to this school.
Well, you majored in Middle Eastern and South Asian studies. You've done an internship at the Afghan embassy in Washington. But here's where your story takes a new turn. You know, there's yet another chapter because you also, through Wellesley, came in touch with Patty Ward. Now, Patty's daughter, Paula Lloyd, also attended Wellesley. We want to bring Patty Ward on the line now. She's on the phone in North Carolina. Patty, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Well, Patty, we were pretty stunned to read about your story in Wellesley magazine because we're well aware who Paula Lloyd was. She was working with the U.S. military as an anthropologist under the controversial Human Terrain Team program when she was killed in Afghanistan by the Taliban. So first of all, our sympathies.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
But, we are talking about fears in Afghanistan about the Taliban. Your daughter, Paula Lloyd, was actually burned to death by the Taliban. Yeah.
She was making a difference, and they didn't like that one little bit.
As much as you want to tell us, what happened?
Well, the thing of it was, is Paula had a history with Afghanistan before this terrible event happened. She'd been there 5 years. She'd been in the military for 1 year. She worked with USAID. She worked with the United Nations. She loved Afghanistan, and she loved the Afghan people. And she realized she was in a very dangerous, area down in Kandahar. So before she left a very detailed statement of wishes if something happened to her. She wanted us to form this foundation to bring Afghan girls to Wellesley.
But now to the new chapter in your life, because through Wellesley, you met Parnian. First of all, what was it like when you heard about this Afghan girl at Wellesley, where your daughter graduated?
Oh, I thought that's just delightful. How soon can I see her and say hi?
Well, she did see her. Meet they did. That's Patty Ward. Her daughter, Paula Lloyd, was killed by the Taliban last year when Paula was working for the U.S. military in Afghanistan as an anthropologist. Paula was a graduate of Wellesley College, as we said, as is Parnian Nazari, an Afghan woman who just graduated. When we come back, how Parnian and Patty plan to bring other Afghan women to Wellesley through a foundation named after Paula Lloyd. And by the way, we want to hear from you. Go to herenow.org. Just click on Contact Us or leave a comment right there. Do you think the Taliban's treatment of women should make the U.S. think twice about the troop withdrawal plan for next summer? Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with two women whose lives have been radically changed by the Taliban. Parnian Nazari is from Afghanistan. As a 10-year-old in Kabul in 1996, she came face-to-face with a gun-wielding man who told her that women didn't have the right to an education. Eventually, she made her way to the U.S. and just graduated from Wellesley College here in Massachusetts. Through Wellesley, she came in contact with Patty Ward. Now, Patty's daughter, Paula Lloyd, also graduated from Wellesley in 1995. But when she was working in Afghanistan for the U.S. military in 2008, the Taliban doused her with a flammable liquid and set her on fire. She died 2 months later. Well, now, Patty has set up a foundation named after her daughter to provide educational scholarships for Afghan women because before she died, her daughter asked her to.
She felt like educated women are the key to helping that country solve a lot of its problems.
Well, and here's Parnian, an Afghan girl who made her own way to Wellesley. And we understand, Parnian, you're now working as cultural advisor for the Paula Lloyd Foundation. What would you advise Patty? I mean, you know, how are you helping each other here?
I think what Patty is doing is absolutely amazing. And when I heard about this story and about the foundation, I felt like I had a lot in common with this foundation, with what happened to Paula, with the mission of bringing students to Afghanistan.
With also, I'm guessing, what could have happened to you? I mean, you were at the gunpoint with the Taliban.
It could have, and it still can. With my mission that I want to help the women in Afghanistan.
But Patty said that one of the missions is to educate women in the U.S. and send them back to Afghanistan. Do you feel safe doing that?
I believe that it's the people of Afghanistan who needs to rebuild their country. And educating women, sending them back to Afghanistan, is definitely one of the great ways for Afghan people themselves to help their country.
And Patty, your daughter died in 2009. And here we are having this discussion now, and I'd love your opinion on that. You know, we're hearing of Taliban leaders being pardoned. We're hearing Afghan President Hamid Karzai saying, you know, I may not be able to guarantee rights for women. I may be able to just guarantee keeping them alive by maybe making some concessions to the Taliban. Again, members of the Taliban killed your daughter. Your thoughts on how this negotiating might go? Do you fear that too many concessions will be given to the Taliban, or do you think that some have to be given?
Well, I have enough faith in women that they will find a way, however the politicians decide to do whatever they're going to do. If we get the women educated and they learn that they have power, they will take care of it.
Well, how about you, Parnian? Do you have concerns? I mean, we know that after the invasion, there was a constitutional requirement that 25% of the members of parliament be women, but then we're finding that some of those women are not voting for laws that would guarantee rights for women. We have this horrific Time magazine cover. This just took place within the year, the young girl whose nose was cut off for fleeing abusive in-laws. Do you think that too many concessions are going to be given to the Taliban?
For me, it's a disappointment. It's actually a great disappointment to see that more than 10 years after what I went through, women in Afghanistan are going through similar things and even worse. The Taliban has not changed, and we are still going to negotiate with them. Every time I read or hear about negotiating with the Taliban, I shake my head and I say, although I am a person who's really for peace, but when it comes to the Taliban, and with what I have experienced under their government, not just me, but my friends, my family members, both men and women, I do not want return of the Taliban. I do not want them to govern any part of the world, not just Afghanistan.
Well, it's interesting. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton also went to Wellesley. Patty Ward, as your daughter Paula Lloyd did, and as Parnian did, she says that the women of Afghanistan will not be deserted. Patty, you said you had faith that that's true?
I definitely believe if people just realized how many organizations are trying to help the women in Afghanistan, to help them not only to bring them to school, but teach them crafts and farming so that they themselves can make some money. It's just mind-boggling to me once I got into this. And I totally agree with Parnian. There's absolutely no negotiating with hardline Taliban or the fundamentalists. Those people don't negotiate.
But meanwhile, Parnian, what a catch-22 defying the Taliban creates. You've said you think Patty's foundation is the answer, you know, to bring women to Wellesley and educate them and then send them back to Afghanistan. But you came here. Do you ever see yourself going back?
I see myself helping the people of Afghanistan no matter where I am. And security in Afghanistan, I know that the more women are educated, the more outspoken, the more they are in danger.
Well, that pretty much says it all. That's Parnian Nazari, an Afghan woman who graduated this year from Wellesley College. We also spoke with Patty Ward, who created the Paula Lloyd Foundation in the name of her daughter, who was also a Wellesley grad. Paula Lloyd, again, working in Afghanistan for the U.S. military as an anthropologist in late 2008 when she was attacked by the Taliban. She died from her injuries. Parnian now works for the Paula Lloyd Foundation, helping to identify Afghan students for admission to Wellesley. We want to know what you think about the overarching theory here. Should women's rights make the U.S. think twice about leaving the country as scheduled? Last week, we spoke with the Oprah of Afghanistan, an Afghan woman who has a TV show in Kabul. She was featured in the Time magazine article on women's rights under the Taliban. Listener Mary Shegrin writes, "As a feminist, I agree that the Taliban has a horrible attitude toward women and a truly evil record of abuse. But the question of what will happen to women in Afghanistan if the Taliban takes over should be balanced against the equally disturbing question, what will happen to women in that country if the U.S. continues to wage war? The war itself, including our bombing, has killed many women and has kept the people of Afghanistan in chaos. Terrible poverty continues. All these conditions make the lives of women horrible. Yes, the Taliban are ignorant, a dreadful combination of evil, but we're not doing the women of Afghanistan any favors by staying." News is next, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Those are Harley Davidsons, a sweet sound to bikers, but probably indistinguishable from the overall roar being heard in Sturgis, South Dakota this week. The world's largest motorcycle rally celebrates its 70th anniversary starting today, and Harley Davidson riders are always the biggest contingency. But Harleys are made in Milwaukee, have been for more than 100 years. You might remember the Fonz lived in Milwaukee. He drove a Harley, but now the company is threatening to move if unions don't agree to what they call cost-cutting changes. Rick Barrett writes the Let's Ride blog for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's all about Harley. And Rick, I think that underscores the importance of Harley Davidson to Milwaukee. The city's paper has a blog devoted to it.
Harley Davidson is hugely important here, not just from a manufacturing perspective. Granted, the company does have thousands of jobs, but it's a cultural icon here. It's the identity of the city in many ways. You've got beer, brats, and motorcycles.
Well, brats being bratwurst and beer being, well, Schlitz and Miller, and both those companies moved. So let's talk about the negotiations. Harley Davidson says it needs to save about $54 million a year in costs. Motorcycles are not selling the way they used to. So what are they asking of the two unions, the United Steelworkers and the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers?
The talks are underway right now, and they're not saying a whole lot. But essentially, what Harley-Davidson executives have told us is that they've got to get the production of the motorcycles more closely aligned with the seasonal demand. And that's a change that's going to require a lot of flexibility from the workforce.
Well, let's explain, because the motorcycles are really made there, the engines and transmissions, the heart of the bike. And they're asking what, to be able to more easily hire and fire workers when there's less demand for motorcycles?
That's probably going to be part of it. And I think they also want the ability to just move people around easier, perhaps between different jobs, or to just have more flexibility within the factories themselves.
Well, Harley Davidson had some tough negotiations with unions in York, Pennsylvania just last year. The company said they would move out of that state, Pennsylvania, if they couldn't eliminate jobs that they saw as being inefficient. And the union, you write, the union called that whip song, you know, getting states to bid against each other for jobs. But Harley Davidson essentially won in York, Pennsylvania. They got to cut jobs and they stayed.
Yeah, the union in York, Pennsylvania, I would say grudgingly accepted a 7-year contract that eliminated more than half of 1,900 jobs. But what it did is it kept the factory from being relocated either to Kentucky or another non-union state.
In your sense, as a close observer of this, is this whip song, you know, is this Harley Davidson just trying to get the lowest dollar, or does the company really need to have some of these demands they're making of unions in order to stay alive?
I think the company's pretty serious about this. I mean, going ahead, they're looking at a situation where motorcycle sales are not going to come as easy as they did in the past. And so they're trying to stay ahead of us. They don't want to become another automaker where they find themselves burdened with a lot of extra cost and they can't keep up with it.
When do you think the decision will be made?
The company has said that it wants to make a decision by early fall. You know, the executives have said they want to keep the manufacturing here, but they're very determined to cut these costs.
Well, meanwhile, Harley-Davidson says any changes wouldn't take place until 2012 when the current labor agreements run out. How are people in Milwaukee reacting to the possibility that the company might leave or jobs might be cut if it stays?
Well, I think people are very worried about this. They've already seen very deep cuts in the workforce in Milwaukee. And there's also the cultural identity here. I mean, people think of Milwaukee, they think of Harley-Davidson. You know, people come here from all over the world just to tour the factory because they want to see where Harley-Davidson motorcycles are made. And it's the sort of thing, even when I travel somewhere else, you tell someone you're from Milwaukee, they look at you, they give you kind of a blank expression on their face, but then you say, oh, that's the home of Harley-Davidson. And it's like, oh, yeah. Then they light up. Then they recognize where you're from.
Rick Barrett writes the blog Let's Ride about Harley-Davidson for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been speaking to us from Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee. Rick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, we'll keep an eye on this story as Harley-Davidson and its unions continue talks. But up next, we're going to go to Detroit. Tough economic times there as well. But that city believes it can lure entrepreneurs and train them and keep them there. We'll hear how in 30 seconds here and now. So right, it can't be wrong. Rocking and rolling all week long. What to do about Detroit? Unemployment is 14%. Thousands of businesses have been abandoned. Can they be brought back? Or can businesses be born and bred in Detroit? That's the idea behind Bizdom U, a nonprofit entrepreneurial boot camp in Detroit. It was founded in 2006 by Dan Gilbert. Now, he made his fortune with the online mortgage lender Quicken Loans. He's now owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers, so he knows a thing or two about loss, losing players like LeBron James and Shaquille O'Neal. But can he bring back his native Detroit? Well, Dan Gilbert hired Ross Sanders to be executive director of Bizdom U, and Ross joins us from Detroit. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, James Smith Moore, known as Jimmy. He's a recent grad of Bizdom U. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Ross, let's start with you. How does Bizdom U work?
We recruit entrepreneurs into our program, and they're in it for 4 months full-time. We provide the cost of the training. We provide a living stipend. While they're in our program, they're also developing a plan for a business that needs to be headquartered in the city of Detroit. That's a requirement. Those who complete the program can receive really two things. One, they can receive funding for their plan, and right now they can receive up to $100,000, and they also receive a percentage of ownership in that business. Now, Bizdom shares in the ownership of those businesses, but we use our share of the proceeds to seed future businesses launched by future Bizdom U grads.
Well, more specifically, Bizdom U starts out owning two-thirds of the business. The entrepreneur gets a one-third share. But once the student pays back Bizdom U's initial investment, it flips so that the student gets the two-thirds stake. Now, people are saying that's pretty good compared to banks that fund entrepreneurs. But let's bring in Bizdom grad Jimmy Smith Moore. Bizdom gave him a grant to start his idea, which is Jimmy Kicks, a website where people can submit and vote on shoe designs. Jimmy, how did you pitch yourself to Bizdom? I mean, what about you said entrepreneur?
I think one thing that helped me make it into the program was the fact that I had some background in entrepreneurship. The first business that I started, it was a lizard breeding facility in my mom's basement. She didn't like it at first because there were, you know, crickets running around the house because, you know, we had to feed the lizards crickets. But I was able to sell to local pet stores in bulk. And I also sold those lizards online.
We should say you were 15, you were doing this, and this was in Detroit.
Yes, in a house on the east side of Detroit.
Well, then at 16, when some local stores ran out of Nike sneakers, we know kids line up overnight when they're coming out, you hired a manufacturer in China to send you some knockoffs?
Yes, that was the case. Well, I wasn't aware that they were knockoffs at the time. But I noticed that there were limited quantities available in our area. So what I did was I did some research and found a factory over in China. I basically asked if they would let me use their pictures that they use on their site for my website, and whenever a customer would purchase, if the factory could just ship the shoes straight from their factory to my customers, so which means I wouldn't need to carry any inventory. So I did that for the entire summer. My mom said if I raised enough money, I could buy my first car. So I raised it, made around $14,000 in net profit, and I was able to buy my first car.
Before receiving the cease and desist letter from Nike.
Correct.
But here, you are a born entrepreneur. Did you go to business school? I mean, you went to Bizdom U, but had you gone to business school before that?
No. I just graduated from Cass Tech High School in Detroit, Michigan. in 2007. And while attending Cass Tech, that's where I just found my love for entrepreneurship during this time.
What did you learn at BizMU? I mean, tell us about some of the courses or a challenge or something that happened there that you learned from.
They've just taught me a lot of the street smarts that I need to run a successful business, such as accounting, business law, how to create a contract, HR. I mean, it was great.
Well, so now you've got this Jimmy Kicks website. People can go on and create shoe designs, and then there's a contest, do I understand, and the best design actually gets produced?
What we do is graphic designers or artists submit designs on our website. Our community then votes on their favorite sneaker, and the most popular sneakers then produced and sold in limited runs. Now, the winner of that wins $500. It's kind of a way for us to do our own market research before putting out a design.
Well, I'm reading in the Times, Jimmy, that you're going to sell these shoes online for almost $80, which they write is more than four times the cost of production. So are you seeing dollar signs yet?
Well, I'm seeing dollar signs. One good thing that I've done that's allowing me to see these dollar signs right now, even before we sold our first shoe, is that I've built this huge following on these different social media networks. Right now, our Facebook fans, we have over 5,000 Facebook fans. We have over 1,800 Twitter followers. So, you know, with that huge following, I'm definitely seeing dollar signs.
Well, and you know what, Ross? I was thinking, he'll be humble and say, no, I'm not. But an entrepreneur better be seeing dollar signs, right?
Yes, of course. We want entrepreneurs to see dollar signs. But the main value we think that an entrepreneur brings to the equation is their ability to create. James is not just selling shoes. James is creating jobs. He's created three jobs over there already. He's taking in profits that will be spent in the city of Detroit. And so the main thing that we love about entrepreneurship is its creative powers.
But Detroit needs huge workplaces with tons of workers and food stores on the corner. Some people might say that's great for Jimmy, and especially a Detroit, you know, born and bred. But it's got to be bigger than that and maybe more close to putting food on the table.
Sure, absolutely. Well, first of all, BizMU isn't going to solve all of Detroit's problems. There's a lot of things that need to happen for Detroit to make the comeback. But we do think BizMU is extremely important because it's fostering entrepreneurship in a city that really hasn't supported entrepreneurship. And when we bring people like James in who can launch these businesses, it's kind of like planting a seed that will foster entrepreneurship in the future.
What are some of the other businesses that have come out so far?
We really focus on businesses that leverage the internet that we can grow without a lot of infrastructure and brick and mortar. So, for example, we have an electronic medical records business that's focused on dermatologists. We have another online apparel business that focuses on alumni of historically black colleges and universities. We have a wedding videography business. These are all businesses that leverage social media that provide services to clients that we can grow and scale.
Well, Jimmy, of Jimmy Kicks, one last question for you. We read you're the son of a single mom. Would you have been able to do this, you know, $100,000 grant to start up a business without BizMU?
Tough question.
You probably think you could have made it happen, which is, again, what an entrepreneur has to think.
Yeah, but I'm humble. I think BizMU has definitely accelerated my career as an entrepreneur. I would have got to the point where I'm at right now eventually. I may have had to, you know, crawl before I actually ran, but right now I'm running.
Wait, my money's on you.
Robin, do you mind if I take a crack at that one,
too?
I think James would have definitely done it, and those are the types of people we need. Guys like James are going to just make it happen. We just help them try to get there faster.
That's Ross Sanders. He's executive director of BizMU, based in Detroit. And we also spoke with James Smith Moore, or Jimmy. He's a grad of BizMU, and funding from the program helped him start the Jimmy Kicks website, allowing you to design your own shoes. We'll connect to that as well. It's going to launch very soon. Jimmy, Ross, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. It's vacation season, so what are you doing? We know you may be swinging in a hammock or laying on the beach doing nothing, but what are you doing? Our next guest says even when you're doing nothing, you're doing something. And our most common leisure activity isn't eating or playing or sex. It's daydreaming or playing video games or watching TV or reading fiction, participating in a world created by the imagination. And not just participating, but believing. Dumbledore's farewell scene. Remember when he died in the Harry Potter series? So sad. Fans were shocked, grieving. But Dumbledore isn't real. Why do we get so caught up with fictional characters? Yale psychologist Paul Bloom joins us now from the studios of Yale University to explain. His forthcoming book is How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. An excerpt of that book, The Pleasures of Imagination, was published in the Chronicle Review. And Professor Bloom joins us with more. Professor Bloom, Paul, welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
And when you say we're spending all this time in our imaginations or in others, how so? Remind us.
Well, think about it. I mean, if you ask people what they like to do the most, they'll often answer sex or socializing, being with their kids. But if you actually look at the amount of hours they spend each day on different pleasures, the imagination wins easily. There's television, there's movies, there's books. And when we're by ourselves, we often daydream. We create fantasy worlds and we enjoy them. So at least looking at it from the standpoint of time spent, imaginative pleasures are easily at the top of the list. Stories and fantasy and game playing and gossip, but also strictly imaginative activity of telling people about events that don't exist, are a huge occupation.
Sure.
Of people around the world.
Sure. Did you hear what happened on The Office last night? Wait a minute. The Office isn't real.
That's right. And I think people often end up caring more about characters that aren't real than characters that are real. People weep over the death of characters in Harry Potter. They obsess over the adventures of people on The Office. And this is just a fascinating fact about human nature.
As you quote one psychologist saying, why do we get so emotionally involved in the lives of fake characters? Why do we?
To some extent, we're oblivious to the difference between reality and things that are not real. So you could really enjoy listening to a couple of people talk and say humorous things, and you could really enjoy watching this happen on TV when you know that this is all scripted. We could become aroused at seeing certain naked people and sexual activities, and you could be equally aroused watching these things on a computer laptop. You could be disgusted at a certain disgusting sight, and then equally disgusted at seeing it in a magazine. To some extent, we don't care. Our minds are insensitive difference between real and imagine. And that's in part because a lot of our experience is brought to us through our senses. And our senses don't make a big difference between something we really see and something we see on television, our movies, or even that which in which we imagine.
Which is why we cry over the death of characters in Dickens, or J.K. Rowling gets letters, people begging her to spare their favorite character in Harry Potter.
She got letters saying, please don't kill Harry, please don't kill Hermione, as if these are real people and somebody is pleading to a kidnapper or a god to protect them.
Some other of your findings. Several studies show reading a fact in a story, even if the story is fiction, increases the likelihood that you believe the fact to be true. And you say, well, sure, we actually do learn a lot of facts in fiction.
That's right. It would be the wrong conclusion to draw to say, look how stupid people are. They learn things from movies. They learn things from fictional books. Because in order to tell a story, you have to include a lot of things that are true. So I've actually never been on death row. But I have a sense of what death row is like. I've never been in a submarine. I've never been in 18th century Russia. But I have a sense what all of these things are like because I've experienced them in fiction. And I could trust a fiction writer and a movie maker is savvy enough to be more or less accurate in how these things are depicted.
It's interesting. It's all virtual because it's in all likelihood passed from their imagination to yours.
That's right. And I don't want to overstate how useful it is because sometimes you could be really led astray. The Da Vinci Code is a classic example of this, where the writer and then later the filmmakers established a world of facts where the facts are actually not true.
Right.
But people read the book, they see the movie, and then they absorb the facts as if they were true. And I think that such facts would stick a lot deeper than facts if they just simply read a newspaper article or a textbook.
But on the other hand, just staying with your first thought about just being able to get an impression of something, I remember asking Stephen Bochco, who created L.A. Mm-hmm. Law and Hill Street Blues and all these terrific shows, and I'd say, Hill Street Blues. I mean, the police would say, that is, he's got it down. And so I said to him, you know, did you ever go out on the beat, and how long did you spend in the station? He'd say, I never left my armchair. He never went once, never looked. So we can.
And in this world, there's often a cycle where where somebody does an imagined product like Hill Street Blues based on their impression of what it's like to be a cop.
Yeah.
And then future cops go and they look back on the show and they reference it. The Godfather and the movie Goodfellas are classic examples where presumably mobsters would later style themselves after these mob characters that were thought up by creative people.
So that's the imagination creating reality.
Exactly.
Do animals have imagination?
Animals, non-human animals, say chimpanzees or say dogs, they often do something which is, I think, interestingly related to the human imagination, in that they play. On the other hand, the flexibility we see with human play, with human pretense to human imagination, I think has no parallels in the animal world.
And again, just if you could put it in a nutshell, why is that so good for us? Because, you know, we've been told it's wasting time. We're supposed to be feverishly working for our survival and the betterment of society.
The big question is, what's this for? What is this imaginary capacity for? And I want to be cautious here. A lot of the everyday use of the imagination isn't for anything. It's that we have this capacity, this mental capacity. We get pleasure from it. And so we seek out these pleasures.
I was just going to say that, gosh, I'm wondering if early on, if you stood around just daydreaming or imagining things, you'd get eaten by a dinosaur.
That's right. You'd imagine an animal that spent its time seeking out mates and setting up shelter and capturing food would do a lot better than an animal who spent his time lying on his back, imagining better things and fantasizing about what the good life would be. But on the other hand, the reason why we have this imagination in the first place is for an extremely powerful and I think very adaptive use, which is to imagine worlds that don't exist gives you a very special power. It lets you plan for the future in that you could imagine alternative worlds, explore what they would be like, and then choose accordingly. It lets you practice. So to some extent, instead of me, I don't know, having a discussion with my friend or making a big sales pitch or trying to seduce somebody in the real world, just having to do it once, I could do it 100 times in my head before doing it for real. And this sort of mental practice, which is something that athletes know about and any performer knows about, doing it in your head ahead of time, practicing ahead of time, is, I think, a gift that allows us to respond far more adaptively and far better in the real world.
That's Paul Bloom. His new book is How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. We've been talking about two chapters in particular on imagination. They were excerpted in the Chronicle Review. We'll have that at our website, hearandout.org. Professor Bloom, Paul, thanks so much. Fascinating.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dream.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Even if you're on vacation, please join us to see what the week brings. Here and Now.
Only trouble is, gee whiz, I'm dreaming my life away.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI. Public Radio International.